in modern democratic systems, we have essentially representative democracies. So local area, local population elects a local representative who then represents for the wider region. And you kind of go, I hope that the guy I voted for represents my best interests.
Of course.
But you understand he might not necessarily do so.
I live unbanked off of cryptocurrency, and I use BitRefill extensively because it lets me pay with crypto at places that don't yet accept it directly. This one service, more than any other, helps me live on crypto. Pay your prepaid phone bill, or buy gift cards to thousands of major retailers around the world, all with cryptocurrency, including for exact amounts so you don't have to buy more gift credit than you need for a specific purchase. You can use BitRefill without an account, but if you get an account, you can earn rewards points, which translate to savings, and you can also hold a balance denominated in dollars or euros to protect yourself against market crashes. Go to bitrefill.com, click Create Account, and enter the referral code DCN, or follow the link in the description. Hey everyone, I have the very interesting and wonderful pleasure of speaking with the one and only Dr. Kapil Amarasinghe. How's it going, man?
Hey. I'm good. Good to see you, dude.
Yeah, so you reached out to me. We spoke several years ago, more on specifically the Particle Project, but you reached out to me to try to basically want to talk about a decentralized governance model for the future and not in a specific, like, well, let's run this crypto project, but how does human society move to a better governance model? You know, a better technocratic governance model from where we are today, and basically update the technology of governance and basically talk about what's maybe missing in the way the systems work today and how we can kind of move to something better and what does something better look like. So I hope I got all that relatively accurate, huh?
Completely. Yeah, completely.
Yeah, so start out. Let's talk about very briefly, because this is otherwise going to be an 8-hour discussion. What's the problem?
It's engagement and empowerment as two words. I think a lot of people these days don't feel they can really engage with their local political systems. And a lot of people don't necessarily feel empowered to, or even when they do engage, they don't feel empowered or listened to as a result. The short of it is, in modern democratic systems, we have essentially representative democracies. So local area, local population elects a local representative who then represents for the wider region. And you kind of go, I hope that the guy I voted for represents my best interests.
Of course.
But you understand he might not necessarily do so.
Mm-hmm. So the problem then is the engagement, the translation of will of the people into actual end result action. One thing I like to think about in this, because I obviously am heavily interested in cryptocurrency, it's money above all, and money is an information technology. It's always been a technology for efficiently transmitting information of what do we value and all around. And then a lot of the problems with money have been problems with the technology, not with the base concept of money. And so the same thing with democracy or governance is a technology, a tool for transmitting the will and the power and agency of the people into an end result. And what we're talking about here is a technology where there's a lot being lost in translation. You're paying a lot and you're working hard for a lot, then you're not getting it.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people feel frustrated about that. You can almost see that. I mean, if you look at UK average local election participation rates, it's 30% typically. You know, 1 in 3 people bother to turn up to vote for their council elections. To me, I'm almost shortcutting, but I feel models of representative democracy that we had worked really well. In my mind, they worked better 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago, as a simple fact, because populations were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I think local populations were smaller. So the relative ratio of voters to representatives, I think, was smaller. And therefore, it was easier for one person to get noticed, raising their voice. Whereas modern society is really different. Working patterns have changed. I've just done two night shifts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know lots of people who work irregular hours, long hours, yada, yada. And, you know, so employment patterns have changed. Lifestyle patterns have changed. Family patterns have changed. The time an individual may have to engage with mm-hmm. local politics and the resources they may have at an average level, if you look across the whole spectrum, you know, some people have more time, money and power to engage with their political system than other people do. And the people who don't have the time to book into their local clinics or write to their counselors, they're the ones who essentially, they tend to be the most vulnerable, and they tend to be the ones who tend to feel the most disenfranchised. And that's kind of where I think a lot of the strain of our current representative democracy model is coming from.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to think about. I have, in my own life, participated in representative democracy relatively a few times, but at the national level, where, for example, in the United States, there's, what is it, almost 400 million people right now off a giant continent space, and it just, I never really had high hopes of that. Where I live currently in the state of New Hampshire is different in some ways because, as you mentioned about the scale, there's 400 state representatives for the state, and it's a population of around 1.5 million people. Okay. So it's much more representative. It's very, you know, I know quite a few legislators on a personal level. I know several who campaigned with no funding. Like, they just showed up, wrote their thing, and knocked on a few doors, and they could get elected that way, like the kind of old school way. And even then, I see those kinds of cracks forming in. And basically, I see exactly what you're saying, and where I'm at in my physical location now is I think it's some, to a certain extent, parts are working, but it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable as things grow. And the amount of organizations that are involved in doing voter turnout and voter engagement and education and things like that, and just to get people to express their will, is kind of a, you know, pretty staggering. Do you think some of this has anything to do with the difficulty in the user experience of voting itself, of getting to the polls, of like, okay, well, I have to go, there's not good information about the candidates, I don't know what they represent, I don't know any of this kind of stuff, it's not really very clear, and then I have to go to a polling location, I have to get out my, it's just such a pain in the ass, rather than just, I'm at home, I get home after work, open up the computer, do my voting site, it says this, 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 that, that, and I say, secure online voting, go through, I'm done.
Yeah, this is, I love the way mm-hmm. you just put that, and I completely agree with mm-hmm. you. It's so interesting. There are two things I want to pick up on, which is education, but actually almost you get at home on your computer, and the instant mm-hmm. thing that I think of is social media. The yeah. thing that most people can engage with instantly is a social media platform. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because there are so many people effectively getting involved in governance style activities, local community organization, local events organizations using social media.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it's actually allowing for direct democratic engagement, that's a very different thing. It generally doesn't allow you to, you know, reach out so easily. And you're right, there's no platform where you can just directly engage with your MP. There's no universal mm-hmm. system which yeah. is easy to understand, easy to access. And that also goes back into education. The world is much more complex than it was 30, 40 years ago. So definitely 20 years ago, and that will be yeah. within my lifetime. It is way more complex. I remember being 16 when, you know, mobile phones were Nokia 3310s. And now look at what we're managing every day. And from that point of view, it's amazing that the technology of making governance and understanding your local governance hasn't actually caught up. And I feel that's a big gap that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that's for sure. The engagement. One thing that I think is interesting in the past U.S. election, the national one for president at least, is we have an interesting situation where when the political game is played, we have a situation where we had a I would say not extremely popular sitting president, and we had a, from where I was able to judge, and I still kind of believe this, an even less popular contender. And in the end, the less popular contender may have won because he was able to get more people to the actual act of voting rather than he was able to get more people to support his policies or more forceful support for his policies. And I saw this in numerous advertisements and all other things like that, other political things. Usually when you vote, at least in this country, it's you have to show up to a polling location or you have to do an absentee ballot ahead of time and all this kind of thing. There were special circumstances because of the pandemic where mail-in voting was okay. And I saw on one side, the smart side of the political aisle was beating that drum over and over. You got to get registered. You got to get registered. You got to vote. Vote today, not tomorrow. Get out of the house. Do it, do it, do it, do it, do it. And so maximize voting turnout. Whereas the other side just did like, well, we'll see if they vote. You know, we have support. They'll go out and vote and we'll see how it turns out. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out well for them and it surprised a lot of people. So yeah, that technological barrier is kind of interesting.
And that's the thing. You've got technological barriers to understanding what your local your representatives want to do. And that's interesting you say this, because it's like a lot of the elections that come locally and nationally, I don't know what these local candidates, it's not necessarily clear or easy. It's not just there in your face as much as other aspects of reality are. And likewise, accessibility to voting, it would be really nice to just instantly, you know, there's loads of people, as you said, getting to a ballot box. If you have significant physical disability, for example, that's not easy. If you work odd hours, that's not easy. If you have childcare arrangements to make, to drive to whatever an hour, you know, that's not easy.
There are all these things. Let me add another thing that might be a little bit darker. If you support someone who's been, perhaps rightly so, vilified in the media as the next coming of Der Führer, right, and you show up to vote, there's always a slight concern for your physical safety at that point. Where
privacy is.
Yeah.
Sorry, I completely am with you on this. It's the people around you. They're chatting. They might be trying to feel you out. You don't get that element of privacy. You know, I mean, yes, when you get into that little booth, but yeah, that there's definitely that sense of social pressure that's kind of going on. And actually, this is another big thing that I feel should be inherent to democratic systems, particularly direct democracy, is actually privacy. You know, your decisions, in order to avoid coercement, people should not be able to identify how you're deciding. They should just understand that a decision's been made. I do think these systems, I think we're getting towards a stage where we can build these systems, by the way, but I think that's a really fundamental, fundamentally important, essential concept of a true democracy is privacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And suppose the old school privacy is you go into the voting booth and there's a curtain and then no one knows how you vote except for the people who count it, I guess. And that seems a little odd, but hopefully there's some, you know, better ways to kind of go. So is this purely a discussion now of the voting technology is outdated and backward, or is the base system itself, is there something up that like with that you would tweak?
So for me, I think it's the base system. As I mentioned to you in our correspondence, I'm a great believer in the idea of direct democracy. So to me, that's one person, one issue, one vote. And I feel that should be the case for everything. Now, facilitating and making that available, I think the technology exists that I think we can build from pre-existing tech and concepts to create a system that would enable that. I'm slightly skeptical as to the time frame because I'm aware that a direct democracy would conflict with the personal interests of many representative Democrats. If you build a true direct democracy system, you would be rendering many of your representative elected officials redundant, or they would need to change the scope or nature of their role in some way, perhaps in moderation, as moderators or something. But I really do feel that that needs to change at base level. And I think if you're building a true direct democracy system, then the voting will very much be much more direct as well. That will be inherent to such a system. So that's my answer there.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the technicals then. So as far as in-person voting is one reason why, is to prove authenticity of the human being, right? To make sure there's no fraud. Because of course, everyone will try to cheat. So when we're voting from home, for example, or remotely or digitally, there has to be some sort of a digital way, digital identity that first off proves who you are. And so it's pretty easy to say, like, hey, you take take cryptocurrency, right? A cryptographic key, that your private key is yours. This is associated with this human being. That's easy enough to conceptualize. Now, first off, how would you deal with the problem of someone losing access to their keys or someone, you know, taking on their behalf, for example, someone voting on their behalf?
So I think you're going to need a multi-layered approach. So for me, the ideal system would be actually, yes, a 24-word private BIP mnemonic or a private key. But then on top of that, I'd probably add a second layer. So maybe high resolution biometric retinal scan, high resolution fingerprint. I would have maybe several layers, and say if you lost one, if you could then produce physical evidence of the other. I mean, it's very hard. You can physically show up and go, this is my retina, this is my fingerprint. You do get, so, okay, can you give me generate a new key or a new derivative? So perhaps it's a tricky, if I really start thinking about the details of this, it's tricky, but there's nothing to say, okay, all right, we're going to render the old private key with that biometric redundant and just issue you a new private key. But then you create a centralized authority. And that's not necessarily ideal in my mind, but it's a pragmatic solution.
Well, if we're talking about current governments that are centralized solutions or centralized problems, I would rather say, but you know, it's a different discussion. But if they already issue you voter ID, for example, you could do, let's just say, a 3 of 3 or a 2 of 3 multi-sig, or even like a 3 of 3 multi-sig where one of them is biometrics, one of them is password related or some kind of thing in your mind, and then the third is a physical device related. Like you just get like voting cube or your voting thing that you plug into your computer, and then kind of like a hardware wallet, you can do that.
Yeah.
You have to remember a password and you have to present biometrics all at the same time. And so in order, if you lose one of those, like let's say you lose your device, you have to go, then that's becomes you go to the central authority again. We're not talking the perfect world yet. We're talking an improvement to the current world. You go to the central authority that issues your voting credentials and just say, I lost this device, but here's my password. And here's my proof of self. Here's my biometrics. And then they can issue that. And then you need all three. So if someone steals your device and steals your password, it doesn't work because they need you too. They need to grab you by the back of the head and coerce you. Which, while we're at it, I wonder how that would work. Because no one can really do that with voting because you have to be in person. And you can't coerce someone in person as easily. You could threaten them at their home, but when they walk into they can do whatever they want. There's no easy way unless you're in on the whole operation. But it's much easier to hold someone hostage at home and just say, go vote this way, or I'll burn the house down. So do you have any ideas on that? And I know that's a very difficult thing to solve. Oh, gosh, yeah. But, you know.
I mean, that's a really interesting thing. So, again, I think this goes back to privacy. So I'm thinking, firstly, I really like that using essentially like a Ledger wallet device. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's actually an ideal solution in many ways. And again, going back to the idea of a password, you know, it's like a social security number or a national insurance in the UK. You know, it's like date of birth. Once you know that, it's kind of hardwired if you use it enough.
Yeah.
Going into the idea of home invasions and personal security. So to me, if you can somehow obfuscate the... let me think about this for a sec before I speak. To me, if the receiving end of the vote is almost anonymized, then even... And if... I mean... Let's see, they'd have to hold a gun to your head while you're literally looking at the screen so they can see you. I mean, from a practical point of view, first, I'm just going to say from a practical point of view, to be able to rally that many people to vote, I think that there are practical issues to creating that scenario to sufficiently sway a vote. But I agree, I'm going to engage with this. I think the receiving end that it needs to, the receiving end almost needs to not just know what the vote was, not who it came from.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily solve this problem here. I almost feel like that my gut reaction there would be home security setups. And then again, that I'm a great believer in you should be able to defend your territory how you please. I'm a great believer in the distinction between private and public property. I think in public property, you know, fine, you observe communal rules, but in private property, it is very much you are the master of your own home. So to me, I feel that's probably going to be in the realm of practical solutions, you know, security setups, self-defense, home defense options. I don't really have an amazing answer for that, if I'm being right now. And I think that's something I need to think back on.
Well, I just overthinking this, obviously, there's no perfect answer. The thing is, with the old traditional systems, you can't coerce someone in the voting booth, but you could coerce them outside of it. Say, if you don't vote for this person and, you know, a murdered family or something like that, or you could coerce them into staying home rather than voting. And the thing is, that doesn't really happen because at scale, the scale you need this, you need a massive criminal enterprise to just attack enough households for that to work. One thing that I think could change this is flexible voting deadlines. So for example, you could vote at any state, you could vote any state during the week, and you could change your vote, and then it would just at the end of the deadline it's over. That's the way the Dash Masternode system works today, is anytime there's a proposal, you cast a vote. And you can change that vote at any point, and as soon as a deadline's over, then that's when it's tallied. It's time. It's snapshotted, and that's the way things turn out. And so some people do little voting games where they vote a lot to try to like make one way to make people vote the other way, but it doesn't really work out that well. But the good thing about that is if someone coerces you and says, you know, vote, you can always change your vote, like when they leave. Or, and the only way that they can't is if they're holding gun to your head the entire time up until the deadline and just saying, like, no, I need to do that, for example. And, you know, that could probably help it. Ultimately, if we make it more flexible like that, I think that we hit the point where it becomes not a governance problem. It becomes a purely security problem where if you have... people running, you know, with that much access to everyone's personal safety, you've already failed as a society in a much greater way than the voting mechanisms.
Yeah. But that said, I think if you combine what you've just said with ensuring the voter ID and the recipient is essentially anonymized. If you anonymize the flow of voting and you just make sure it's just a case of decisions relevant to this locality, and you've got flexible deadlines where, you know, your multi-sig biometric individual can change their decision at any point up to the deadline, actually you've got a lot of resilience built into that system.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I think it's better than what we have.
Yeah, so especially if the voting keys use zero knowledge proofs, so you know that that person voted, but you don't know who voted or what they did for. It just
it
goes there, then you don't have those kinds of issues. Now, as far as if we just go to the representative democracy model before we, you know, go to a better one, perhaps having that public, as far as a public voting record that's not, you know, encrypted, it's not hidden for the representative. So everyone votes for representative. That's all anonymized. But then the representative votes and all that is publicly viewable. Of course, like, that's already kind of out there right now with like public voting records, but it would help to, you know, have it like on a blockchain where, you know, anyone can build up their own vote tracker instantly, like a block explorer. And then it's easier for anyone to see that. Now, at that point, we run into what I don't think that there are enough of these of voter aids out there. And one of those things, for example, a whole bunch of organizations track voting records of legislators, and they say, this person has a good scorecard according to our values, therefore they're good, or this person has a bad scorecard, and they're kind of act as a third-party service for the people to match their desires with the representative of that outcome in the practical sense, not just in the campaign line that they say sense. And I could imagine that becoming a much less of a, okay, well, you have to donate to this nonprofit and you have to pay attention to their newsletter when it comes in. That could probably be turned into an app that it almost like a survey, it matches you to your candidate, and it also matches you to your desires to the candidate's end results, to where you say, I want lower taxes, more firearms ownership rights, and I want to build a strong border wall, let's just say. Like, let's pick those issues, for example. And then you want to, like, for example, a stereotypical Trump voter might want those kinds of things. And so you put those, and then you voted for someone. And when you're picking who you're going to vote for, you run it through this app. And it goes, okay, this person didn't vote for any of those things last couple times. And then you just say, well, I'm not going to vote for them at all. And then it just kind of goes that way. And so that kind of automated pairing, which in a voluntary way, by the way, not as part of the system, but as part of an attachment to the system from a, you know, oh, maybe you pay $10 a year for this system to just, you know, to fund the app development. But now we go, you're talking about representative direct democracy, where you don't vote for people and hope they vote for what you want. You vote for what you want. So how would that work, do you think?
I'm just going to see if I can do screen share, but the other thing, what I'm going to bring up is, if you go to, I'm just going to Google Kialo, because this is really where it kind of fell into place. So let me just, I'll just share you the link. It's kialo-edu.com. But if you just Google Kialo, then it will, it'll pretty much show up. Where's the little chat box on Jitsi? That's what I want to find out. Just so I can. I can't Google it, but I'm going to see if I can screen share with you. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
Also, let me bring up the thing. So let me do a screen share. Is that basically, I sort of mentioned this in the little preamble before we started recording. Mm-hmm. Kialo it's a governance tool. It's an online governance tool that allows you to visualize and directly participate and create debates. So in Kialo, you can effectively ask a question or say, should we do this? Yes or no. And then you could do, then any user can essentially put pros, any user can create cons. Under each pro, anyone can put comments in, you can have sub discussions, you can upvote and you can downvote. So once you go into Kialo and basically have a look, let me just find the screen share button. Once you go into a Kialo debate and have a look, you can very quickly see all of the respective pros. You can see things that have been generally upvoted. You can see arguments against arguments. You can go into micro minutiae, effectively. Mm-hmm. You can go into the smallest levels of detail, and you are open to participate in that system, as is anyone else who's got the access to that particular board. It's almost like a Reddit subthread, but it just is more sophisticated.
And so the first place my brain goes to this is spam. So how do you stop one person from asking hundreds and hundreds of completely irrelevant questions just to clog up the board and ruin it for everyone?
So for me, it would be using like the upvote downvote mechanism in Reddit. If you get enough downvotes, you effectively accrue negative karma. Those people, they kind of, it's almost like you get, although this does allow for a certain amount of social engineering, so it's not ideal, but
of course,
if people keep spamming the board, you know, if enough people keep downvoting, obviously in my ideal scenario, that would be anonymized. Can you see my screen, by the way?
Yes, I can. Kialo Edu.
Yeah. So this is Kialo.com. Yeah. So explore debates. We'll just go into politics and, you know, here's an example. Should communism be preferred over capitalism? Hell no. I'm going to click on it anyway. So new to Kialo, I'm just skip that. So you can kind of, we're going to enter this debate, and you can then literally see here is the question. You can see the pros, you can see the cons. You can see the comment here, collective progress is given more importance. And then obviously you can click that. And if you'd like it, you can do that, or you could then go, no, I don't like it, you know, in an alternative system. So then you could look at other cons, and you can keep basically exploring. You can keep going down the rabbit hole of each argument, as it were. Sorry, let me just go back to the root question here. Mm-hmm. So to me, this could be, okay, you're an individual. Getting to the answer to the question, if it's a case of you've got that private key / biometrics and you're registering yourself to a certain locality, that's recognized. So that might be like a postcode, a zip code, or some sort of assigned territory.
Yeah.
You could essentially log in to something that's equivalent to Kialo interface. Let me just go back to, you know, and then you could literally explore all of the relevant questions. You could see all of the questions and you could propose questions. So if a person keeps proposing pointless questions in debates, you could set essentially a voter threshold. So if a person is asking pointless questions, but there's simply not enough engagement, then those questions will, then those proposals will not actually be acted upon. So I would say a minimum threshold of participation, because obviously you don't want one person to create a proposal on behalf of that community, and then he just votes on it and it gets passed. And then suddenly you're getting, I don't know, Christmas trees being planted in schools in the middle of summer or something stupid, if you get what I mean.
Of course.
I think you need to have thresholds. Sorry.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about, there's obviously two different layers to this. There's the discussion layer and then the voting layer. And as far as like a Reddit style discussion type thing, I never liked the ability to hide via downvote, because that obviously encourages brigading. But having an open participation thing where more engagement comes to the top via, you know, or more positive engagement via algorithms or whatever, is an interesting, you know, that's the way social media kind of already puts the better content up. Of course, different algorithms are a little weird. That kind of works for discussions. Now, when we're talking about structures, and the biggest problem with representative democracy is the weak point, which is the representative. It's not that people vote. It's not that they vote for the wrong things necessarily, although lots do. It's that the person they vote to represent their will gets intercepted, man in the middle attack, more or less, right? And then they don't carry out that will in the end. Now, if you have a direct democracy, at that point, the point of interception is in the framing of the thing to be voted on. And I'll explain this briefly. With legislative activities, it's easy to just write a basic bill that says, oh, I think that this should happen. But then how does that play out legally? Is it even legal to start with? What are the unintended consequences of the bill? All that kind of stuff. And for example, in some areas, they have legislative services, which basically goes over the bill. If you submit a bill, say, I want this to do that. And they go over to make sure it works. It's an effective, it works as intended. And a lot of places, at least in the U.S., have these things called model legislation, where a professional group will write a bill according to, you know, basically make sure it does its best job of what it's supposed to do. And then other states will take a almost copy paste that bill when they want to pass their own version of this, and then they might tweak it a little bit, but they take the base template, because if they write theirs from scratch, it could have a horrendous, disastrous consequences, or just not do the thing at all that it's meant to do. And so that's what representatives and all those other things are, the professional side of things. That's what that provides, is it makes sure that, you know, the actual end result is a good result in theory. Of course, in practice, you have that, but then you also have, you know, well, it's an infrastructure bill, and then it's 97% not related to infrastructure and all related to, you know, obviously, you know, terrible spending projects that are completely unrelated, and adding extra onerous regulations on the crypto industry. Now, what does this have to do with bridges and roads and stuff? So that happens too, but whoever frames the question controls the answer. So what do we do about that? Let's just say, do you want to vote for, let's just say, legalized marijuana? Because there's a lot of places in the world where it's still not legal. And if you say, well, I want to vote yes for that, but whoever frames the actual question just says, do you want it? But then this person has like a 60% tax rate on it. Only you have to apply for an expensive license to get it. All this kind of stuff that's fit into the question. The average, I wouldn't say dumb voter, but the average voter that is not a professional is going to see this question and say, I want that. And they vote yes for that. And then there's the unintended consequences that come with it. Whereas another vote would just say its use is completely not regulated in any way other than as a food stuff. Like it's completely, almost completely no special regulations. It's just legal now. Anyone who can sell food has to do this. It's regulated under the food safety body or whatever like that. Or it could just be it's not regulated under any of that stuff. And so there could be very different outcomes behind the will of the people. They want to vote to legalize marijuana. So basically, who controls that end part there? Who writes the questions?
So in my ideal world, mm-hmm. it would be any participant that's biometrically linked themselves to that region has the opportunity to write a question. Mm-hmm. However, perhaps how I would then structure it is, here is the core question, mm-hmm. and then any individual in that region can put immediately underneath it alternative proposals, as it were. So yes, we kind of agree with this, but actually we'll go down this road and here's a tweaked version, and then there are the pros and cons, and you could then get the next alternative proposal, which anyone can participate to. If you're then going to start saying, you know, if we're going to say this is going to affect FDA regulations, your mm-hmm. questions, you probably have guidelines which go, yeah, if you're going to reference the regulations, please link to the relevant document so that mm-hmm. people can actually read that piece of legislation if they want to, or at least a summary of it and the full document. So I think as long as you give that system flexibility to allow its participants to create alternative proposals, I'm a great believer that societies kind of thrive, will live and should live and die mm-hmm. by the the intelligence and foresight of their participants.
Of course.
And I think you need to give people the ability to engage and to create alternatives. So that's my answer to that. I don't think it's necessarily a fixed proposal. I think this is the fixed proposal, but here are the alternatives. And then I guess you could then vote, you know, you see the collective vote and then go down that decision. The more interesting question then becomes, what is the minimum threshold? I mean, I think you need a minimum threshold of participation, and then what is the minimum threshold for the proposal to pass? Or maybe you could then go, okay, we've eliminated this proposal, and now we're on to round two, and these are the alternatives. And perhaps you could then allow for an alternative to emerge in that scenario. And if you could then vote to say, yeah, we'll accept that as an alternative option. If you get what I mean. So you can introduce lots of degrees of flexibility here, which I don't think exist in current models.
So when I'm thinking about the weak point, which isn't this, that which leads to a thought of not just weak points, but also like benefits of when you have, let's just say there's eight different marijuana legalization measures on the table. Yeah. And then they're all grouped under the same, this is what this does. These are variants. At some point, there might be something that says, like, legalize marijuana and all drugs. And at that point, that could be seen as not the same. It has overlap, but it's completely separate. And so do you think that the grouping mechanism should be a sort of an automated one by keywords or something like that, that's just like, well, it does this, it does that, and it just automatically groups things together in the system. Of course, automated means less precise or accurate, perhaps, but also not gamified, right? Not gameable, where if it's not automated, then you have to have someone making those decisions, and whoever makes those decisions can just say, I'm going to put,
bias.
Like, there, I'm going to, I don't want all drugs to be legal, so I'm going to put that as a marijuana legalization option. And so knowing that that one's not going to see its fair day in court because it'll be beat out by other purely marijuana-based things that then end up being at the top. So by deciding which category it's in, you can game the system. But of course, if it's automated, then it's just based on like certain number of tags and subject matters affected. If there's like a 3/4 overlap or 2/3 overlap, then they automatically get stickied together. If not, then they get spread out. And the automated thing is good, but then you can imagine how people can game the automated system by just throwing in some random little buzzwords and then, again, attaching, making it all about spending and taxes, for example, even though they have a very minor attachment to all these different things that make it a marijuana bill. So therefore, their thing goes to the top. But anyway, what do you think about that? Which approach of those would you rather favor?
So I don't like the idea of a central moderator. I think when you put one person in charge, you're essentially allowing all of their potential biases to filter through into decision making. And then you just go back to the problem of centralized systems. Ultimately, it's just it's a different form. I think if you're going to design automated keyword, it's probably a bit more objective, but you still need to be quite mindful and aware of not putting biases into the way you code and build such a system.
Yeah, of course.
Or make sure it's subject to a certain amount of scrutiny. I mean, we're talking about the building blocks of a new society here. So that's something that would need to be really looked at and debated thoroughly in its own right. I would veer towards almost an automated system, but as a safeguard, I would say if an automated system might just flag up and go, this proposal might not actually be really relevant or might not really be appropriate in the context of the question, rather than outright ban it. And I think the other thing is, if a proposal passes, there's nothing to stop you, a member of that region, just creating another proposal, which may have an overriding effect. So you could go, okay, we passed this, which is specific to marijuana, but the all drugs thing didn't go through. Well, then let's just put the all drugs proposal through. Or likewise, the all drugs proposal went through, but then it might be that we change our minds. And then there's nothing to stop someone going, okay, well, actually, let's change this back. Let's change this again. And this is what we've got. This is how we change it. And then you've got engagement on pub and participation again, which is the key thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting to think about this whole, human behavior is very fascinating to me. This is really what this is all about, is human behavior at the end of the day. And human behavior always tries to maximize positive impact for the individual, and then the individual's attempt to do that, and tries to minimize negative impact. And so when we have one thing that I find very, I guess one of the biggest, most frustrating things about public discourse is we have a zero-sum game of power, and everyone is scrambling for that piece of power. Whereas, you know, in anything else, you have more of a voluntary system where if, let's just say, I like to drink coffee, and as long as I have access to my coffee, I'm happy. People who don't want to drink it don't have to participate. And then it kind of is a much less contentious or attempt to be gamed sort of a system. And that's where we get into like a deeper kind of a level, is now we start to let's just think about adding layers. It's not just, do people vote? Is it one person, one vote, and whatever they vote for goes through? But what if we added, and this is just a thought, like a thought process, what if we just added an ability for, if someone is not affected by this, they don't get to vote on it? Now, that'd be an interesting thing to think about. And it's much harder to, obviously complexity makes the system more likely to have bugs, of course. But for example, if you are voting, like in older systems, this was a, not everyone could vote, obviously, but in before it was different ethnic groups or different genders or whatever, it was based on, at least in the US, I believe it was based on landowners, as in stakeholders, people with something at stake could vote. If you didn't have anything at stake, if you weren't a taxpayer, you didn't vote. And now we have non-taxpayers voting to get taxpayer money, and that's a problem, right? That's presented into a problem with the welfare state and other things like that. And so, for example, in a purely financial way, if you could say, do you contribute to the system? If so, you have a say in how the money is spent. If you don't, you only have a say in things like social matters, like legalization of this or criminal record of that or things like that. But then if you're trying to redistribute money, you must be a net contributor of that money, and your vote has a weight on only financial affairs in proportion to how much you contribute. So that's just another idea. And going back to the whole the Dash decentralized autonomous organization, that's how that works, because the governance system, although it does allow you to answer questions of should we do this or that, it's primarily to fund things, and whoever has the more money in the system gets the more vote as far as funding things, because they have the most to spend, they have the most to lose. And that's simple, because it's very specific. It's not like, it's very specific to how is money distributed. But so, what do you think of the idea of adding a restricted, a selective voting power kind of element based on who's actually affected by something?
So my take, I'm probably going to have a slight degree of divergence here. Yeah. It's interesting what you mentioned with the Dash system, because with Particle, we've got a governance system as well, a CCS-driven engine, and it's a staking network. So your staking power, effectively, the more you've got, the larger your vote effectively is. And, you know, to be honest, I think for that network, for a cryptocurrency network, and for Particle and for Dash, I presume as well, I think that works great, because the people who hold the most stake in the system actually do have the most say, or get more say within proposals. Where I have divergence with this is when you apply it to what vast swathes of population, and I look from an individual circumstances point of view. So From a personal background, I'm an emergency medicine doctor. Mm-hmm. I practice at consultant level. I've been doing emergency medicine for about 10 years. So I regularly see the most vulnerable people within society. I work in the UK. It's a free mm-hmm. healthcare system. It's very different to the States. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've grown up on. One thing I would say is when you're talking about allocation of funds, if the people who are voting on the allocation of funds are the people who hold the most funds, they will mm-hmm. naturally vote to represent their own self-interest. Mm-hmm. Now, the key thing here is, and this is almost a divergence, but it mm-hmm. comes down to empathy spectrum.
Yeah.
How you vote and how you decide and how your self-interest is represented falls into where you lie on the empathy spectrum. So to explain that to anyone who's not heard of this or thought about it, if you have zero empathy, then your concept of the world is completely in relation to you and you alone. It's almost like it's a very isolating view.
Yeah.
And that's where you get sociopathy and, as a subset, psychopathy. People who act purely for themselves, whereas people who are very empathetic or higher on the empathy scale, their idea of self-interest is more likely to incorporate other people. So whenever you have a resource-based system where the power of your vote is kind of dependent on how much of the resource you already own, mm-hmm. then your decision-making, then the benefit to that society, it really comes down to what level of empathy you have, mm-hmm. like where you stand. If you're a very empathetic cis person, your idea of self includes a lot more people than someone around you and within the society than someone who doesn't. And therefore, you'll naturally vote to kind of keep in mind or be aware and mindful and keep out for the best interests of those people. Whereas if you don't have that empathy, you will just go, screw you, this is all mine, and I don't really care what happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the potential danger, is actually a system that's designed to empower and enfranchise and allow engagement. If you suddenly don't have financial resource, or you're delegating that to people who do have financial resource but lack empathy, mm-hmm. then you're suddenly cutting those people off. I think this is I don't really have a problem with companies like Amazon mm-hmm. or with Jeff Bezos accumulating wealth. That's not the issue. The underlying issue that most people have with Jeff Bezos is if you go through the media and it is the stories about how workers in Amazon warehouses are treated and mm-hmm. stuff to do with minimum wage and health insurance and things like that. But those are standards of work and living, and they're very much, that's, to me, this is me playing amateur bed armchair psychologist, and that's not really fair on Jeff. But to me, that's kind of like, he is in so distant a world to mm-hmm. the majority of people who he works for that he probably has no real concept of them. And to be honest, he has no reason to care.
Mm-hmm.
He has absolutely no reason to care. If you were to try and mentally put yourself in the picture of someone that wealthy who's in that sphere, and I say this having been in so many mm-hmm. different spheres of wealth in my own life, you know, mm-hmm. it's very easy to become detached the better off you become. That's just from personal experience.
Yeah, now let's take that in a slight... So we have this in... On the other hand, when we have, let's just say 10% of, or for argument's sake, let's say 50-50. 50% of the population contributes 100% of the tax revenue, and 50% contributes zero. Those 50% will always vote for money that they don't have, right, from there to there. And on the opposite end, if it's purely based on money, you go in the system, sometimes you'll have people contributing, voting to give to other people. But generally speaking, they're probably going to maximize. They're not going to be able to get more money because they contribute all of it, but they will try to get rid of as little of it as possible, at least on that kind of a sense. So might there be a a 50-50, where it's like an average, where your voting weight on purely financial issues, again, not on other things, is an average of your personhood, which everyone only has one, everyone's only one person, and your net worth. So you take those two numbers together and divide them, right? And so the voting for financial issues is therefore weighted towards the people who are actually contributing those finances, but not entirely. It's still the people with no money are still have a disproportionate for their contribution say in how the money is spent.
I think that's a bit fairer. I think if we're talking about weighting systems, I know there'll be a lot of objections to such a system, and I can understand where they're coming from, and I can understand the concerns about that. I think that's a bit fairer than an all or nothing approach. That's my take on that.
Which is kind of currently what we have, right? In the government world of today, we have an all, as in all voting rates for everyone. And then we have a nothing in the purely financial DAO world of cryptocurrency, of only money. And so a hybrid model would be kind of interesting, although I don't think that people with more money should be able to vote on rights, like what rights you have or legal structures or what's legal or not. I don't think that necessarily, because it affects everyone regardless of, on an equal level, regardless of how much money you have. So I don't think that extra finances should have an impact on that. But as far as your finances are concerned, if you say like you all join an organization voluntarily, let's just take a voluntary example of we're all going to participate in an association for the neighborhood, to neighborhood defense or whatever. And then your voting weight of like, as far as who do you contract to defend the neighborhood, could be half based on your actual contribution to this nonprofit defense organization, and half based on just your membership in the geographic area. So therefore you kind of spread both of those kinds of things out. Yeah. You kind of get both.
Yeah. No, I'm seeing where you're going with that. And I think that's a fairer system than an all or nothing approach.
Mm-hmm.
I really need to sit down and think about that in more detail, because I'll be honest, this is a new idea to me. And I do find this interesting.
Everything here is kind of new to me. I'm making it up as I go along. It's just
But from my point of view, sorry. Yeah.
People don't think about these kinds of things, and so to just sit down and actually think about it out loud is probably a great benefit.
Yeah, I certainly feel I want to sort of think about this particular thing, because this is a new idea from my point of view. I haven't considered this. I do think it's fairer as a base, and actually it goes back down into me. When I came up with this idea of how we can progress to a direct democracy, I'd never considered from the point of view of welfare states and taxation and contributions. I've always personally come from the view that my personal views, we should just have a flat rate income tax, because I dislike the idea. I could give you personal examples. The UK, I don't really want to get into this, because I'm sure you've thought about it lots as well. But I personally don't. I think if we had a flat rate tax system, firstly, it would be a much simpler for people to understand.
Yeah.
And secondly, it wouldn't penalize you for your personal financial success. I don't think there should be graduations there. I think it should just be a flat rate. And that's where I lie. I consider myself very much, from an empathy spectrum point of view, I consider myself very much straight down the middle. I like to think I think I'm fair, but I don't think someone making, half or a quarter of what I make should pay the same tax as me. Likewise, I think the same person making 10 times as much as me should have the same flat income tax bracket. That to me would, to some extent, almost render what you've said irrelevant, because people who necessarily aren't making as much money, they're still contributing the same ratio of earnings to taxation. So to me, that would be the actual way forward. I think actually, if you really ask my question here, I think there should just be a flat rate income tax, a flat rate business tax, and that's it. And yes, there will be ways to, I think it would be harder to game that sort of system, personally, than the current system we have. I know so many ways to game our current tax system legally. And, you know, the Panama Paper rules. There's so many people who do. Well-off people who are educated, have time, and have looked into our financial system know how this game works. Mm-hmm. But as I said, I'm a great believer in fairness. So from my point of view, flat rate taxation. And as I said, going back to the beginning, we live in a more complex society. Fun fact, when I learned recently, 16% of school leavers in the UK are functionally illiterate, which, you know, if you're looking at, you know, if you're projecting ahead 10, 20 years, you know, that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, it's a bomb especially waiting to happen.
Yeah, it's pretty fucked up when you consider that our society is way more complex than it was 20 years ago. And they're having to now navigate this mm-hmm. world with that kind of, God, you know, that's such a handicap to navigate. That's just a disability to start from, you know. So from my point of view, if you can simplify taxation, I think you can almost get around that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I agree with you, that's better. What you've proposed is better mm-hmm. than an all or nothing system. And I agree to you. I agree with you. It is frustrating that people who may have no financial contribution to a system, and that works both ways. If you're incredibly poor or incredibly rich, your proportionate contribution to a system from a taxation point of view may not necessarily be as much as other people. You can get great disparity. So from that point of view, that's where I stand. Sorry if I rambled a bit there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that gives a relatively good picture of kind of where we're going from as far as, you know, a better world for governance. First off, you create a anonymous, secure, blockchain-based voting thing that can be done from home at any time during, like, the voting period. And that already helps things out. And then rather than voting for representatives who then have that kind of an issue, you vote for direct issues. And when you get to those direct issues, obviously there's a polling mechanism that allows voters to be able to, you know, decide which one they want or not. And then there's a grouping, an automated grouping system in this case. And obviously this is not a proposal for this is the way the world needs to be tomorrow. Go, you know, vote my it's just a thought exercise, right? But as far as then you group and vote out the best one or not, and then that kind of gets implemented. And then, of course, we're talking about voting weight and contribution requirements, as in, first off, who gets what is it, the contribution rate, the tax rate, and then an idea of a voting weight, whereas purely on financial issues, you could possibly average out two things to make a little bit fairer in that way. And so I think that's a good place to leave this for today. If we want to do a follow-up, one thing I think is interesting is participation in the system at all. And it doesn't mean how active you are as a willing participant in the system. It is whether you consent to participating in the system to begin with. And I think that one thing that's kind of interesting about that, and this is just, I'll leave it as a teaser, I guess, for next time, is in 2020, the state of California lost over 100,000 inhabitants. So much so that their representation in the national, in Washington, D.C., actually they lost a representative because those are allocated based on population. So the population of California went down by such a significant amount that you actually lost representation there. Similarly, New York had an exodus of over 100,000 people in 2020. I'm sure in 2021, it's orders of magnitude higher on these places. But basically, people are, because of the ability to select your own framework by physical jurisdiction, you've had millions of Americans moving around the country to select the system that they like better and then can vote under. And so that kind of like says, do you want to participate in this system or not? If you say, I don't even want, it's not just, I want to vote and I want to win. It's just, I don't care if I win or lose. Or let's be honest, I'll probably lose. I don't want to do that at all. I want to play this game at all. I'm leaving. And then they are able to go in the same system to a different place. And then, of course, that begs the question of what things should people be able to opt out of or into? Because obviously in a perfect world, you can opt out of everything. But then there's things that affect all of us. You can't just say, well, I'm not paying taxes. I'm not doing this. Everyone else can handle it, but I'm still benefiting from the protection of the system. And so that's a lot of interesting stuff to look forward to, don't you think?
Yeah, I would definitely be happy to do a follow-up on that. And yeah, I think that would be yes.
Well, yes, we'll schedule another thing. Well, this is your self-promo time. Where do you want to direct the listener, the viewer, etc., to learn more about either you and your work and follow you on social media, or things you think that people should read up on for this subject?
I think the most... So if you want to follow me personally, mm-hmm. I would suggest Twitter. So my handle is @thegreatestdoc, but I'll be upfront, I'm not that active on there. The place you'll find me is in the Particle Project, in mm-hmm. their Discord, or if you go to their Discord, Telegram, or Riot channels, mm-hmm. I use the handle Joe Sky. So if you want to mm-hmm. just speak to me, go to the Particle Project and, you know, go to those channels. I'm there literally every day. I'm a moderator there. We have an amazing community of polymaths who happen to find these subjects really interesting. So if you want to talk about stuff like this, this is an amazing place to go, because this is our kind of our common goal. And likewise, a project that I'm passionate about, as I said, as we mentioned, I'm an advisor to the Particle Project itself. So if you go PARTICL, so particle without the E on the end, you Google that, that is an amazing project. When we did that development, by the way, the Multi Markets is out now. So feel free to download Particle Desktop 3.0. Because, you know, if we do a future podcast, I could talk about decentralized e-commerce in at some point. And if we go around the roadmap for that, that's just phenomenal in its own right. But yeah, I would say that's the way to get through to me. Is that cool?
Yeah, sounds good to me. All right. Well, everyone, thanks for listening. It's a little bit of a departure from the usual stuff, but I figured it would be, it's adjacent. And it's a lot of times when you're thinking too much about, well, this crypto project here or that decentralized tech there, you're not thinking about where we're going as a society as a result of all this technology. And it's interesting to kind of explore what that can do for the future of how we structure our very society. So anyway, that was really great. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and yeah.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and donate to support the show by going to my Cointree page. That's cointr.ee/thedesertlinks, and leave a message with your donation. Check out the show's sponsors. Live on Crypto with BitRefill. Buy absolutely anything with crypto with Shop and Bit. Avoid content censorship with Odyssey. Protect your privacy online with NordVPN. Get paid to search with Presearch. All links are in the show notes.